Hello and welcome to Artisan Ancestors, a podcast that's all about researching and understanding the creative lives of people from the past. Whether you're a local historian, genealogist, or just interested in those everyday creative expressions, this is the podcast for you. I'm John Kay, the host of Artisan Ancestors. Hello and welcome to this episode 29 of Artisan Ancestors, the manifold meaning of things. Trying to stay true to my word, I'm trying to put these things out more often, and also trying to keep them a little bit shorter. This is a podcast where I want to talk about an idea. Not because I'm a great scholar on the subject or necessarily have my mind wrapped around it, but because it's something that I need to think about a little bit more and try to put into practice in my work. So what do we mean by the manifold meaning of things? Basically, the discourse of things, objects out into the world, is politically charged. That is, when someone tries to tell you that something means something, they have usually some skin in the game. They have something that they're trying to push off on things. In reality, objects have multiple meanings, and they depend upon who you are when you're looking at them. They depend upon what the context is sitting around them. And it's not that objects necessarily mean only one thing. But within the world, it's often translated that way. So when someone tries to tell you what the American flag stands for, it might mean something very different in hanging in Arlington Cemetery or at Ground Zero on the anniversary of 9/11. But it then also could be something very different in the Middle East when it's being burned. And the problem is when these contested understandings of things and how they're used in the world become challenged, people try to tell you what those things mean at different times. Well, not everything has to be that politically charged, but it's good for us to think about what objects mean. To understand all of this a little bit better, let's take, for example, what seems like a very straightforward object, a quilt. But quilts can mean different things depending upon the quilt and depending upon the maker, the receiver, the viewer, the audience around it, the context in which it was made and used, all those things that we keep talking about in the podcast. Now, a quilt could be an example of personal artistic expression. I think of Faith Ringgold's work, African-American quilt maker. A quilt can be a sign of cultural heritage, a cultural marker, like the quilts from the G's Bend quilters down in Alabama are wonderful examples of that. But then the local tradition, the cultural marker of that, has now been amplified out into the world and have become, people are buying kits, and you can actually turn that cultural marker now turns into a commodity. People make those quilts, and it turns into a gift, and they give it to someone. Quilts can be made for celebrations, graduation presents, wedding presents, baby showers. Quilts become these tools for communicating something to people and for sharing in those situations. They become political. Worked with the Sisters of the Cloth, and they made a wonderful quilt. One of the members pieced it together. Sisters of the Cloth is an African-American quilt guild up in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And I took them to the Smithsonian Folklife Festival this summer. Wonderful experience. And one of the quilts they had was basically told the story of civil rights and African-American struggle in the United States. And it kind of culminated with a center block that had President Barack Obama on it. Just a beautiful quilt and had lots of meaning both embedded and embroidered into it, but also meaning when people showed it, meaning when people viewed it. And I don't know that we could ever get at what that quilt really means. The truth is, it has manifold meanings, has many meanings. Remember, I found a quilt top that belonged to my grandmother, and it was a quilt pattern called the Drunkard's Path. I later found out that it was blue and I knew that it was blue and white, but I found out that the blue and white became signs for the temperance movement. And I knew that my grandmother had grown up during the temperance movement here in the United States and was very much vocal. She had this poem that she would quote about Blossom, a young girl who was killed trying to get her father to leave the tavern. So objects are invested with all these different meanings. And we as researchers need to try to not just find out what an object means, but kind of tease away at it and try to find the many ways that objects can communicate, what the many meanings are. As soon as you think you've figured out what an object means, you've lost the battle. Because the truth of the matter is, you should always be looking, you should always be interrogating. Just because you find one meaning, I guarantee you it's like an onion. Just keep peeling away at it, and there's going to be, underneath each layer, there's more, and there's more, and there's more. And sometimes the more you peel away at it, like that onion, it gets stronger and stronger when you get down towards the middle. But unfortunately, many people working in this type of work just want to look at the skin of the onion. They don't want to dig too deep into it. And so in local community museums, objects take on somewhat superficial meanings. And that's one thing that we have to be very conscious of. So how do we try to understand what objects mean? This gets into a key concept, I think, called semiotics. Basically, semiotics is the theory of signs. And basically, it's the idea that all things are signs, and grows out of understanding of words and what words mean. But for material culture scholars like myself, it has to do with this understanding what signs mean and how objects can be signs. And we could be talking about food, we could be talking about clothing, we could be talking about objects of all different kinds and trying to understand what they are as signs. What do they signify? And there are two scholars that are kind of credited at this, and I promise you we're not going to get too deep into theory here. That's not what I'm intending. But there were two scholars that kind of put forth this idea of a theory of signs. There's Ferdinand de Saussure, and then there was Charles Peirce. And the Peircean approach is more what we here in the United States, at least, have latched onto, because he provided a really nice rubric for understanding signs. And he was saying that there are multiple types of signs. And he divided them up into three types. There's the icon, the index, and the symbol. And the simplest way that I found to understand this, it actually came from a wonderful book by Wendy Leeds Hurwitz called Semiotics and Communication. And she provides a lot of really great information in that book. But she gives this example of the signs associated with a wedding. So we can think about, and I'm not sure that these are the ones that she used, but think about this. An icon is something that resembles the thing that it stands for. So it could be a photograph of a bride, or it could be the little statues of the bride and groom on the top of the cake. Those would be an icon. Basically, it takes it from like the icons within within Catholicism or Orthodox religions. So you have the icon. It's something that resembles something, and it stands for something. Dollhouses could be another example of that. Then there is an idea of an index. That is a part that stands for the whole. And so we get that with like the wedding cake. It's become very traditional here in the United States. You save that top tier of the wedding cake, a small one, and then the couple eats that on their first anniversary. So that part stands for the whole. The part becomes the symbol of their life together, the wedding, the bounty that they have. They keep that part of the cake to reference the whole wedding. And it becomes this index for them to relive. So a part stands for the whole. Then the third one, and this is the one people talk about most often, I think, is symbol. And that is when something stands for something else, but is not directly, has anything to do with that other thing. And in keeping the wedding metaphor moving forward, It's like the bride wearing white. It references purity or virginity, but really there's nothing to do with white and any of those aspects of the person. It really has to do with, it's a symbol of it. There's nothing intrinsically inherent in the color white that makes it stand for purity or virginity. It's something that's just grown to symbolize that. And so this theory of signs allows us to look at things. Is it standing for something? Is it referencing something else? Is it a symbol of something? And some of these are easier to negotiate out than others. Like I said, I'm not a great theoretician, but not by a long shot. And I'm not a semiotician. But I thought that understanding some of these would be a helpful tool for us. What got me thinking about this whole topic is the fact that there's been a new copy of a book called Functions of Folk Costumes in Moravian Slovakia by Peter Bocatero, if I'm saying his name right. But there's been a release of several of his work. He was a Russian formalist, and they've translated some of his work. And so this is something that was written in, I think, the 1930s, was later translated here in the United States in 1971 into English, and really a great book if you want to try to get at this idea of signs. Quoting another Russian scholar, Volosinov, Bogatreev writes, "Some things, such as natural phenomena, implements of production, household articles, etc., have no ideological meaning. We can use them, admire them, study their construction thoroughly, understand how they are made and how they are used in production, but try as we may, we cannot consider such a thing as a tank or a steam hammer, for example, as a sign referring to some other object or event." He's saying some things are just what they seem to be. They're a tank, they're a steam hammer. It's quite a different matter, however, if we take a stone, paint it with lime, and place it on the boundary between two farms. That stone will take on a certain meaning. It will no longer simply be itself. A stone, a part of nature, it will have acquired another new meaning. It will refer to something that is beyond itself. It will become a signal, a sign of definite and constant meaning, i.e., of the boundary between two portions of land. And that really gets at what we're talking about, that sometimes things become these signs, and we have to look for those. And those are the objects that I've become most interested in. Last week's podcast, where I talked about photographs, I talked about the baskets that I'm interested in. And one of the reasons I'm so interested in them is because they become signs for cultural heritage in this little part of Indiana where I grew up and live. But there's nothing intrinsically distinctive about these baskets that would make them cultural markers. They no longer are used to gather corn, but they're used to display a sense of local identity. Much in the same way that rock is no longer just a piece of natural material, but has been moved and placed in a place so people, when they look at it, recognize it as being something different than just a piece of nature. It's actually a boundary marker. Thinking of that notion of a tank only being a tank, not having any other symbolic meaning, I think about out in front of several of the VFWs, the Veterans of Foreign War establishments, they'll have often former military equipment that's parked there. You go to a courthouse here in the United States, and you'll see cannons from the Civil War or replicas of them on the lawn there. They're no longer used for defense. They're used as signs of sacrifices that were made, of patriotism, of the roots of where we came from. So I'm not sure I buy that a tank only is a tank. So if we're going to be good material culture scholars, if we're going to be good at being able to understand our artisan ancestors, we need to be looking for what meanings are embedded in objects. Bogatreev writes that just like a driver learns to read road signs and the markers that are all around them, our soldier learns to read the patches and medals that are on, people read the uniforms of military figures, we too have to learn to read these material signs that are all around us and what they're referencing. All of this talk about signs and meanings reminded me of a conversation I had with an Amish buggy maker up in Shipshewana, Indiana, John Miller at Miller Carriage. He told me that he made most of his buggies for the local community, and locals, because their buggies had evolved from old doctor buggies, the ones with the boot, as he called it, or the little trunk on the back, had a very distinctive style. He talked very matter-of-factly about it, but I had to be honest, I hadn't noticed any difference between those buggies and all the others I had seen in photographs and travels that I had seen of Amish buggies. Basically an Amish buggy. Amish is a religious sect that we have here in Indiana that believe in leading a simple life, a plain life. And their carriages, their buggies, are basically black canvas boxes, often is what they look like. And they all kind of look exactly the same, which is kind of the point. But to someone who's tuned in on that, those buggies have a very distinctive look. They can tell if someone's from the Ohio community or the Pennsylvania community, if they're from southern Indiana or northern Indiana, based upon the style of the buggy. And so there's meaning invested in that. And those buggies, they become a sign to me of Amish country. But when an Amish person sees them, they might be seeing a very different sign. He also told me about the stages in people's lives when they get a buggy. When someone joins a church, they get one style of buggy, smaller buggy. Or they get married, they get a nicer buggy from their family. They might get a two-seater once they start to have a family. They might get a longer buggy where the seats fold down so the children can sleep in there if their family has grown. So each of these things, which are just real practical decisions, kind of can become signs. They communicate things, and people learn how to read those. It's a way of recognizing that there's often more than what meets the eye when you're not part of that inside community for looking at things. Well, I think that's all we've got time for today. I want to thank you all again for giving Artisan Ancestors a listen. Hopefully there was something in today's show that you found useful. I want to encourage you all to go over to iTunes, log in, and leave us a review if you enjoyed this show. One of the things that helps us spread the word is to make sure that we get positive reviews in iTunes so that folks will give it a listen. It's also a way that we kind of move up in the rankings there, and I'd love to see us actually have a little more presence in iTunes. Also, feel free to share it with others out there in the world. As far as a takeaway thing, I'd love to hear back from y'all. If you go to the Artisan Ancestor website, there is a little tab on the right. Just click on that. It'll open up a window so you can leave a voicemail or voice message. If you do that and you ask a question or make a comment about the show, I'll try my best to work it into the next episode of Artisan Ancestors. So until next time, keep up your research of the creative lives of people from the past. You've been listening to Artisan Ancestors with music by Martin Simpson and hosted by John Kay.